In the second part of my conversation with Stephen Mills, we talk about the psychological and physical ramifications of living in fear. Stephen shares his story of his quest for health, and ultimately he confronts his abuser. I also asked Stephen if he could rewrite his story, would he? His answer is jaw-dropping. After you left Thailand pretty abruptly.
Yeah, I did. And I actually had, toward the end of part two, I had to get a visa renewed to stay in Thailand and cross the border to Malaysia to go to a Thai embassy to get the visa renewed just off the coast of Malaysia. And I was, at that point, my physical, I was so sick and I wasn't sure what with, but I really collapsed. I wound up in the hospital in Penang, which is that island off Malaysia. And that was sort of the end of the line. I finally had to acknowledge that whatever it was that was stalking me and whatever was taking its toll on my body was not going to be, I couldn't get it dealt with. I couldn't get the care I needed in Southeast Asia. So I wound up flying home to New York, which is where I had grown up. And that begins part three of the book, which is called Reckoning. And that part begins with my about 1.5 year journey through medical doctors trying to figure out what the hell was wrong with me, because I had all sorts of head problems, gastrointestinal problems. I went to tropical disease specialists and GI specialists. And at the end of the day, they diagnosed lots of things and treated them, and I still had all the same symptoms. And so I finally, the father of a friend of mine, who is a neurosurgeon, recommended that I go to see this psychiatrist who specialized in biofeedback. And his name was Dr. Kenneth Greenspan, and he ran the Biofeedback Institute, or actually it was called the Institute for Stress-Related Disorders at Columbia Presbyterian. You know, it's a very well-known hospital in New York. I went to see him, and I told him my story in brief. It maybe took 15 minutes, and that's all it took. And he said, you know, it's good you went to see all those doctors, you know, to rule out underlying disease, but I can tell you right now, you've got shell shock. And I was like, what? What isn't shell shock from combat? And I said, I've never been in combat. He said, well, that may be, but you've got shell shock and you're sleeping in a combat zone. You know, I'd been having these night terrors for years, and my system would kind of melt down during sleep and my dream life. And that began, by the way, this is 1981, PTSD was added to the diagnostic manual that year, but it wasn't yet widely known at all. And it wouldn't really enter the parlance of therapy. Trauma and post-traumatic stress syndrome wouldn't enter for many, many years after that. So guys like him were still using this World War II and Vietnam War term of shell shock, which was, of course, what soldiers suffer after being under fire and in combat for too long. Today, we know that this is quite common in victims of childhood sexual abuse. The nervous system responds in a very similar way to combat situations. And I did many, many months with him, and until he saw that my demons, as he put it, you know, were not going to respond any longer to the biofeedback techniques he was using, which actually were quite helpful. They helped me to relax for the first time in years. And he also put me on antidepressants. That was my first go-round. This is tricyclic antidepressants in the early 80s. And I was able to get a job and hold a job, but I was still very much debilitated by psychologically and somewhat physically by whatever it was, by the evil spirit, as Mrs. Pham had called it in the refugee camp. So he sent me to a psychotherapist, and I did very intensive talk therapy for years in the early 80s. And, you know, at the time, and it wasn't as if childhood sexual abuse came out immediately. It took me a couple years before I even mentioned it because I just, if you've been through that as a kid, there's a real distrust of anyone, especially authority figures. But when I did, when I did broach it, that began another phase of coming to terms with what had happened. And then things happened in pretty quick succession of sort of recognizing it in that therapy setting, meeting the woman who would become my wife, who was the first relationship I ever disclosed in. I mean, actually having an honest, open, intimate relationship. I'd had many girlfriends. I'd never mentioned that I'd been sexually abused. Again, this is quite common with men. In fact, I was just speaking to another victim of the same predator last week who told me it took him 30 years before he told his wife about having been sexually abused as a kid. And I know plenty of men who have never told their wives ever, and they're in their 60s and 70s. So that sense of shame runs so deep that it's very tough to disclose even to the people we're closest to. Having been in this, finding some safety in that relationship with my wife, and then as I describe in the book, just other random things. For example, my wife and I discovering MDMA, what we call ecstasy, the drug ecstasy now. This is 1985. Right when the FDA under the Reagan administration had declared MDMA illegal and made it a Schedule I drug, but there had been evidence already that it was very helpful in treating trauma and in psychotherapy settings. Of course, today, almost 40 years later, MDMA is under clinical trials all over the place, at Hopkins, at UCLA, at NYU. It's now widely recognized to hold a lot of potential in treating trauma. And my wife and I were kind of pioneers, accidental pioneers in using MDMA for treating trauma back in 1985. That was the taking MDMA several times sequentially enabled me to actually relive the experience and to face it for the first time and to feel what had happened. And that was an amazing thing because it let me face the full, without fear, because that's what I had been living in for decades, but to really be with the terror and the violence of what had happened to me. And I'm convinced that when it comes to trauma, the more you can safely re-experience what has happened to you, to that extent, it releases you. And that's what my experience was, that really began releasing the grip that this sexual assault had on my body and my psyche. And it would continue releasing through that and, various other therapies, both talking and somatic, that I did over the decades. And, that's just an ongoing journey. I'm still very much in it now in my 60s, but of course in a very different place because of all the different modalities I tried.
Wasn't it Mrs. Pham who said you can't run from trauma?
Well, that was, she implied it and I said it, because of course she wouldn't use that terminology. That was not in her framework of the world. She would certainly have said, you can't run from the evil spirit. you've got to turn and fight, or you need to arm yourself with, whatever you have to arm yourself with. And ultimately, that's really what I did. I found the tools to help me to face what had happened and to start releasing the shame and the guilt and the fear that had been running my life for decades.
In facing it, that had to be terrifying going into it. But once you experienced it, I would guess that it was an enormous release. And did that just open the floodgates for everything else?
Yeah, it did. And it wasn't as if it was all at once, but there's a sense of, the underlying you know, I think what happens when you experience this kind of childhood trauma is that we spend so much energy denying that it happened, right? That's what denial is. It's there are these feelings that want to be felt, and we make sure they're not going to be felt because they're too terrifying. They're just, and there's a certain wisdom in that, because if you feel them all at once and you're not prepared, or you're not in a safe space, whether that's a therapist's office or with someone you love or whatever that safe space is, it can be overwhelming, and that's quite dangerous. And I certainly urge people to take baby steps when it comes to these types of facing trauma from our past. But for me, it did open the floodgates in the sense that everything I had tried to deny about that experience flooded back to me. And because I felt safe, part of that was the drug and MDMA. There's just, in my experience, the fear is gone. And I was with this person, my wife, who I loved and helped me feel safe. I was able to let it pass through me and recognize it. It just seems so obvious at the end of the day that, oh, this happened to me. And that's what I need to accept. You know, I experienced this violent attack at age 13, and it happened. And now I have to get on with my life, understanding and recognizing that it did happen, and I can look at it safely, and I can recover, and I can heal. But until I had really looked at it and felt it full force, it was tough for me to move on. I was very much stuck at that moment at age 13. And that, of course, that's what happens with trauma. It freezes your body and freezes your psyche, you know, in many ways.
You know, one of the themes that comes up that I think resonates with many of us is the idea of running away. Goodness knows I have used that in my lifetime.
Sure.
What did you think that, in retrospect, what do you think that you wanted that to accomplish?
Running away? Not to feel what was there. It's just the ultimate, you know, my wife and I kid about this because there's still part of us that will at the first, you know, I don't want to say sign of pain, but our go-to coping mechanism with difficulty is, you know, like, oh, you know, let's go to Greece, or, you know, it's just that impulse. And you just, you know, we've become aware of it and can almost joke about it that, you know, and we moved many, many times together. And that's, of course, just a deeper level in our experience of running away. And this began in the late 80s. We moved probably a dozen times. And it's always the fantasy that finding a new place, some ideal environment, perfect life, then the past will dissolve. And of course, that's not what happened. You know, the past is alive and well in our bodies and in our psyches. And at the end of the day, you've got to stop, sit still, and face it and feel it. But it took a long time to come to that recognition. You know.
But I think a travel does offer perhaps a mirror back to yourself, and it also offers you an opportunity to be free of a lot of the societal constraints we might face in our day-to-day lives. And I think there's value in that.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think if you let go of that more, the way we were using it, which was to try to salve something that couldn't be salved or fixed, you know, and you really start working with what the real issues are underneath, then you can come to appreciate what you just said. You know, so now when we travel, I think travel is the most mind-expanding thing you can do because you're pulled out of the, you know, your day-to-day habitual patterns, whatever they are, and you're plunked down in some place that is literally foreign, right? And it just gives you a whole different appreciation of the people around you there, and, you know, perhaps your life back home, you know, when you see the contrasts. And yeah, I think travel is just a spectacular, you know, gift to oneself if you can do it.
That's a good way to put it, actually. The third part of your book you called The Reckoning, and I was just blown away by the courage you showed to go after this gentleman and to reconnect with so many of the boys that he had, whose lives he had touched. How did you find
it? I'd say lives he's destroyed, but I won't.
Destroyed. Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite tragic. And it's very common for, especially men abused as boys, to think you're the only one. That was the most common thing that I heard from victims that I called, and that's what I had believed, that I was the only one. Part of that is because you're groomed to think you're the only one, and your world gets very claustrophobic because of the shame and this sort of needing to disappear. So you're not really paying attention to others or what this person might have been doing to others. But invariably, when I'd call and speak to other victims, they'd say I thought I was the only one. I just spoke to, you know, since my book came out, someone contacted me and we spoke last week. He said the same thing. I was sure, I was the only one. So, you know, for him, it's very affirming to know that you weren't alone and this happened to other people. And it's one of my hopes for the book, is that it will let those victims, some of whom I know, and I'm sure many of whom I don't know, realize that they weren't and aren't alone in this experience, and to try to give them a little bit of hope. And beyond, of course, just that circle of people, to the millions and millions of us who were abused as kids, who know that experience of isolation and powerlessness, which is just a terrible space to be as a child, and coming into adulthood, it just haunts you and tends to run your life unless and until, you know, you're willing to grapple with it in some way. And I hope that the book does offer some an experience that people can see, reflect back at them what may be possible, and show, I think, some resilience. Because I think there's a lot of, I didn't understand that at the time, but now when I look back at the story, I see that beneath it all, I did have a lot of resilience. It's the only way I can explain how I was able to not only survive, but also, yeah, to track him down, to go to law enforcement, to find other victims, all those things that were just, I guess I'm just wired that way. You know, I was just so horrified that other kids were at risk. And I'm still horrified today, you know, that we don't do enough to protect children. And so a lot of what I'm focused on now is advocating for kids.
You know, you bring up when you bring up isolation, that's really interesting, because I think that as an adult now, I can look at situations and say, wherever there's isolation, that should be a red flag, whether it's in a relationship, whether it's in a business situation. But when somebody is trying to isolate you, that is something that you need to take a hard look at.
Yes, that's exactly right. And in all of the best child protection protocols, it is called a red flag. Literally, that's red flag behavior. If an adult is isolating a child, spending inappropriate one-on-one time with that child, that is should set off alarm bells immediately. It's just not, there's no reason for it, and it's unacceptable. Obviously, I'm not talking about in structured environments of tutoring or mentoring or anything like that. I'm talking about in group settings like camps or, you know, youth groups, church groups, things like this. Showing favoritism you know, quote unquote favoritism. Of course, it's something much more sinister than that, but inappropriate one-on-one time is definitely a red flag. And we're, you know, we're social creatures. So by all means, even as adults, if someone becomes isolated, it's a warning sign.
What are some of the other warning signs people should look for?
Well, the sort of the classic red flag behaviors of what we now call grooming are too much one-on-one time, overnights. You know, a lot of times still to this day in youth group settings, you have overnights where you actually have an adult sharing a room with one or more kids. Absolutely problematic. Physical boundary violations. One of the things that abusers will do is test limits by physically touching more and more aggressively a certain child or children. So the sort of physical interaction between adults and kids, and use of special favors or gifts, you know, from an adult to a child that, again, is showing a certain kind of favoritism and may be viewed by the kid and parents as a positive thing, like making the kids special and therefore the parents and family feel special. I mean, I depict this very clearly in my book in part one. I mean, my family was completely conned by this guy. He did that by using his power to confer this sense that, oh, I'm paying attention to you, therefore you must be special in the community. And there's an enhanced status because of that. So, you know, that is another warning sign. Any adult working with children should be committed to the group of kids equally, you know, without all of these, you know, so-called special favors, special touch, special gifts, special overnights, you know, anything that is veering into singling out one child is a red flag.
Have you come to see what the predator's perspective is in all this?
Yeah, that's a really, the short answer is no, because the older I get and the more, of course, as my book describes, I had two confrontations with the man who abused me. The first was in 1978 in person, and the second was in 1986, a 40-minute phone call that I tape recorded. And it's excerpted, that phone call, in the book, because he confesses. But it's absolutely clear that he is completely clueless about what he did to his victims. And so I'm not a psychologist. I can't tell you if he was a sociopath or a psychopath, but I can tell you that he did not have empathy. And when you're dealing with someone who doesn't have empathy for human pain, it's really tough to get inside their head and know what's going on. Of course, there are experts who do this, and so for example, I've been lately spending a lot of time talking with someone named Jim Clemente, who's an ex-FBI profiler who did exactly this, you know, profiled child sex predators. And Jim Clemente, probably most of your listeners probably know him, not as ex-FBI, but as writer-producer of Criminal Minds, which is probably the longest-running true crime series on TV, on CBS. I think they're about to do the 16th season. They're bringing it back. You know, Jim is the kind of guy who, and also, by the way, a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. We have that in common. And our stories are weirdly similar of what happened to us. And we both wound up going to the FBI at the same time and the same FBI field office in New York in the 1980s. he's someone who spent his career studying predators, and you know, he's the kind of person who could explain to you their MO and their how they manipulate both adults and children. And my experience of it is that these people are really gifted con artists, and are able, and this is part of the problem we have in recognizing sex predators in communities and group settings, whether it's churches or Boy Scouts or, you know, Jewish social service agencies where mine worked, is that they're pillars of the community, and they're usually revered as professionals, and they have tremendous authority and power in the community, and questioning them is unthinkable, and certainly no one's going to question them about entrusting children to them because you've hired this person because it's understood that they're brilliant and trustworthy and 100% ethical. You know, they are masters at using that cover to manipulate everyone in the community. And they start with adults, right? I mean, adults get groomed first, then they move on to the children. But it's hard to read my book and not come away feeling like, wow, this is a sort of master con artist on so many levels who had no experience of someone else's pain, whether it was a child's pain in assaulting them or the parent's pain in how he had played them. They're just acting out some compulsion, and it's very tough to relate to. I mean, we can all relate to a compulsion, but that, you know, that kind of compulsion when it runs their life. I was never able to, and still I'm not able to get inside his head.
Your book is really a quest to find your soul. What are some of the life lessons that you learned about going on this quest for your authentic self?
Keep moving forward, having faith that as bad as things are, another door is going to open, and you never know where it's going to be or who's going to present that opportunity. But I just had one door open after another when I most needed it, and wasn't even necessarily particularly looking for it, but was somehow open enough and maybe desperate enough at certain points to know that, oh, well, there's something here being offered, and I should find out what that is. I'm a big believer in if you've suffered trauma, trying anything and everything and seeing what works. And I did try anything and everything. You could barely mention a mode of therapy that I didn't try, or medication for that matter, you know, back when I was really suffering. So I really suggest trying whatever you can and seeing what works for you. We're all different. Every person is absolutely individual and in many ways unique in terms of the way we're wired and our life experience and what our needs are. And there are so many wonderful offerings out there today that it's, and because of the internet, you know, one can find and hook into ways of paths of recovery and healing that were not available at all 30 years ago, even 20 years ago. And so that's phenomenal, you know, and I'm still taking advantage of those things. I'm now I'm part of a virtual men's survivor group that meets once a week, and it's fantastic part of my life, you know, just to have that support every week
Has
from
child abuse increased, do you think, in our lifetime, or has it always been there?
It's definitely always been there. I mean, one sad stat is that it has definitely increased during COVID. I mean, during the pandemic, you had kids locked down with their abusers, you know, many of whom are family members. Probably one third of all child sexual abuse is by family members. And another 60% is by adults who the child knows. It's only 7%, according to the best studies, is by adults who are strangers. So this whole fixation on, you know, stranger danger and watching out for the weirdo by the playground is really, yeah, once in a while that's what happens, but that's incredibly rare. I mean, sadly, we're most in danger from either adults in the family or adults in positions of authority in the community and youth-serving organizations who were not properly screened and controlled. So it's there's no question that child sexual abuse, despite how far we've come in understanding it, is epidemic. I mean, that's according to the CDC and every other public health agency in terms of the numbers that we see today. You know, the good news is we understand much better how to protect kids. And, you know, that's why I'm focused on advocating for much stronger child protection measures to be adopted by any organization that has youth programs.
You've come out of this life experience with so much strength. If you could rewrite your story, would you?
No, I wouldn't. And that's pretty wild, right? Because for decades, that was really this 1,000-pound anvil I was lugging around. And the day my book was published, I was on a podcast with Jim Clemente, the ex-FBI guy who I mentioned before. And I was telling him how much lighter I felt, you know, with the story out in public. And he said, well, this is your liberation day. And that really captured it, I think. You know, all this, the secrecy and the silence and the shame, you know, that I'd carried around for so many decades went poof the day the book came out. And that's, I wouldn't change it.
And the book again is called Chosen, a memoir of stolen boyhood. I have to say, this is just an amazing read and I would recommend it for everybody. It's about abuse, but it's really about a quest for your soul. And it's just a beautiful book.
Thanks so much for having me, Pat. It's really an honor to be on your show.
Thank you for joining us today. I hope you found something in today's podcast that inspires you along your own life's path. Because sometimes a bump in the road is actually a portal into a more conscious and meaningful life. You can subscribe to our free podcast at www.bumpintheroad.us or become a premium member to hear the full conversation. Just go to www.bumpintheroad.us for more information and to sign up.